Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 105 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So normally this is where I'd say announcements this week, but really this whole episode is kind of like announcements. So I feel okay with not doing that section of it and just calling this Welcome to Comic-Con.
Certainly was an adventure. And the first part of that adventure was getting down there. I, Ginger, drove down. Summer flew down the same day, different times, and then we drove home together.
Right, and I think we would have driven down together, but I needed to work that day, so I was like, well, I'll just eat it and fly down, and then we'll drive back together. So what time did you leave on Wednesday?
6 a.m.
6 a.m. I was told in no uncertain terms that anything I wanted to pack in her car had to be...
By the door
at like...
Or in the car, but by the door.
Before 6 a.m.
Yeah.
So I got up at like...
4:30
something, and I got all my stuff done because I had to get ready for work, and I got everything done by the door, and I'm usually like ready to go walking into the living room at like 6:30, but because of the time and everything, I was walking everything ready to go at like 5:30 to make sure I had everything done in time for her to leave. And then I sat in my living room for like an hour longer than I normally would, because I was like, well, now what?
But you survived, and we got down there separately, and I took all your stuff, and you didn't have to do much on the plane.
Well, as a whole other thing, you had to do a lot to get on the plane. Being on the plane wasn't that big of a deal. Getting through airport security
is usually where the big
was the issue.
Are.
Now,
before you get into the plane, there was a while before you got into the plane. But, yes, I left at 6 o'clock, 5:50 or 6 a.m., and I left. I think I arrived around 2:30 or so. There was a little bit of traffic. It wasn't bad. I think I pulled off once to fill up. Other than being, I wasn't sore or cranky or anything. I was just over the drive. The drive back was fun. But, anyway, so I got down there. It was pretty uneventful.
Was there anything time-wise? Super interesting that happened during that day?
So I got there, I parked, I met Sarah in our hotel room.
So no?
And then Sarah and I'm trying to bring it up to the time about when you left so you can take over. So Sarah and I, our plan was to go to preview night. Neither of us had lunch, or she got there around noon, but we were both hungry. We met Marifel there. We got downtown, and the idea was to go pick up our badges at 3, although we found out other people who had press badges got them earlier, so... It was a big old question mark, but we got there after 3 o'clock. So our plan was to get the badge, go have a late lunch, early dinner, and then go back downtown by 6 to do preview night. That essentially happened. So then we were done, and we kind of shared a little bit our pictures from Abby Shaw and everything. That pretty much is how things went down just before you got there. So around the time... We were just getting there, just after 6. You were just trying to board.
No, I was just trying to get to the airport.
At 6?
Roughly. My flight wasn't until 7:30.
Oh, you had flight issues, too.
My flight was not scheduled to leave until 7:30. I got to the airport probably a little after 6, not too much further than that. Walked right in, wasn't crazy busy. As non-busy as it was, the security line was actually moving pretty slow, which I thought was strange. But I put my stuff in the buckets and took my shoes off and pushed my things into the metal detector or the x-ray machine, whatever they call that thing. And they had one of those giant x-ray machines. I don't even know what
the
they're
little
called.
Spinny things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you stand in the middle with your arms up and the detector kind of spins around you and takes some sort of a weird picture. So I took it, and I stood out, I walked out, and they were like, could you just wait a minute? And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I turned around and glanced behind me, because you can kind of see they have the image. Now, this was not as graphic as the images that they would show on TV when those things first came out.
No detail.
Where you could see, like, everything going on. Yeah. These were just kind of like, it almost looked like restroom figures.
Oh.
And then,
Well, that's good to know. And then our bits aren't really on display.
Well, not on these. Not on the monitors that the public can see, apparently.
Oh, that's sad.
But, and the indicator is that there is a yellow dot or a yellow zone where... where the issues are, whatever the issues may be. And so I turn back over my shoulder to look, and I see that my little restroom figure
is issues.
Has what looks like I'm holding a globe of yellow, like a yellow ball in my hands. And right over my crotch is like a gigantic, yellow issue.
You said yellow was where you had issues, so I'm saying you, right over your crotch was a giant yellow issue.
Yes, it was a giant yellow issue. It was round, and it was like this, like it was like this giant yellow dot, like right over my crotch region. And I'm like, oh Lord, what is that? And I'm literally racking my brain because
what did I put in my crotch?
Exactly,
what
did I put in my crotch? Exactly. And I'm thinking to myself, I put nothing in there. I'm not carrying. I was not, you know, asked at the sidewalk to smuggle anything. So I was actually kind of confused as to what might set it off. The only thing I could think was that it was my Spanx. I was wearing one of those, like, the Spanx slips that kind of, like, you know, slides down or whatever.
Which we'll get to later on, but they actually gave her, they almost killed her a few days later.
Anyway. So I'm standing there, and the woman, the first woman, I should say, comes up to me and she goes, she was like, I need to pat you down in the groin area. And I was like, oh, really? I was like, okay. And she's like,
basically all of...
And this is me standing, like, out in public
in front of everybody. All the action Summer didn't get in Scotland.
I was like, okay. And she was like, I need you to, you know, put 1 foot forward, 1 foot back, like... And she was going to pat down my thigh. And she goes... She was like, now I'm going to use my palms on your thigh... But when I reach your groin region, I will use the back of my hand. And I was like, this is awkward. Okay. Okay. I'm trying to be compliant.
What's more awkward? Her doing it or her talking about it?
Probably talking about it. But then it gets even more awkward because she then says, I need to call my supervisor over because I can't get the machine to clear it. And I'm like...
Did you have to go back through?
No.
Oh,
well, they had one of these, like, Band-Aid swabby things, like the fabrics.
So you were not only packing something, you also had...
She rubbed my hands.
You also had residue on you.
Oh, yeah. I did not have residue on me, but they checked me for it. But for whatever reason, she did not have whatever skill was required to pass me. So she's like, I'm calling my supervisor over. And I was like, okay, still need to be compliant because, you know, people get arrested for, like, saying the wrong things. So I'm like, okay, that's fine. And then this woman, this other woman comes over and she says to me, would you like me to take you to a private room? And I was like, well, that all depends on what you intend to do with me. I'm like, if it's, you know, is it something that I need to be in a private room for? She's like, well, I mean, it's for your comfort, but let's just go ahead and go to a private room. And I'm like, okay. She then collects my belongings and two other women and Summer, take me back.
Summer's like, I'm not making it to Comic-Con.
And takes me back to a private room. While in the private room... Because apparently I find out at this point that one of my bags has set off the other machine.
So not just your body, but your bag.
Yes.
Good Lord.
So I've got...
Why didn't you give me that bag?
Oh, my gosh. It was my purse.
Oh.
All I had was my
purse. Has been everywhere.
So I've got... she's carrying my shoes. She's carrying my bag. She's carrying my backpack
She basically was your servant.
Kind of. And so they're going through my bags, and while going through my bags, she discovers that I have a Leatherman tool on my keychain that I'd forgotten about. So that's what set that machine off.
Oh, did they take it away?
They did. She was like, do you have anyone maybe on
is
the
it
other
a knife?
Side? It's had, no, it's like a, a tool, it's got little scissors on it.
And okay.
She goes, is there anyone, you know, here that you can give it to? And I was like, on this side of security? I was like, I think that kind of defeats the point.
Yeah.
And she goes, no, I mean, on the other side of security. And I was like, no, I just got dropped off. Yeah. I don't have anyone here.
My family doesn't care about me.
No, it's just
they're just.
I'm surprised they gave me a ride.
Exactly.
So I was like, no, just throw it away. It's fine. She goes, well, if your flight gets canceled, you can't come back for it. We will be destroying it immediately. And I was like, really? You have like a knife destroying facility on site where you're going to like melt it down for like parts. I was like, okay, no big deal. I'm like I said, keep it. And then I proceed to get a secondary pat-down that was a little bit more graphic. But what I said to her was, I was like, I'm honestly, it has to be my Spanx. I literally, there's nothing else it could be. And I don't think there's, like, metal or anything else in Spanx. But whatever it was must have been reflecting the radiation or whatever the machine is using to look for bombs or guns or metal or whatever they thought I was smuggling in my crotch. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I start grabbing my skirt, and I was like, at this point, I'm like, if you want to just look, and she's like, ma'am, please don't pull your skirt up. And I was like, okay, I'm trying to get through here as quickly
as possible. Was she, like, trying to say, like, don't, basically, don't assist us, let us do all the looking?
Well, she didn't, she was, I think she didn't want it to be, like, a harassment issue. Like, she was, like, that she was telling me that she needed to look under my skirt.
Yeah.
So I think that she was trying to make sure that it didn't become some sort of weird incident, even though I was offering because I was trying to get through security. I was like, do you need to see anything? Can we move on? So she pats me down again, runs one more of those little fabrics through the machine to make sure there's no residue on me, and she basically gave me the clear then. But, I mean, that's the most action I've had in, oh God, I don't even remember the last time I had that much action. Anyway, so I make it through security. And now at this point, I'm like, I can't believe they didn't even buy me dinner. And luckily, right next to our gate was a wine bar. So I went and I sat at my wine bar and I was having a glass of wine and a little meat platter. And then I find out that my flight has been delayed. Mm-hmm. My flight was supposed to leave at 7:35, was now not leaving until 8.
Which is not too much.
It's not too much. But I would like to point out, there was no inclement weather. Neither in San Diego nor in Sacramento. I couldn't find a single reason why they should have delayed the flight.
They may not have told you.
Maybe.
But usually they tell you.
Maybe if it was mechanical, I'm glad they didn't tell me. Because I didn't want to worry about that. But they did catch up to almost their original delivery time. Mm-hmm. Delivery time. What's the word? Not departure. Arrival time. In San Diego.
Oh.
So.
They flew fast.
Yeah. I mean, once I got through security and got a little wine in me, I was pretty golden. And then, you know, the flight was uneventful. I got to spend some time in the wine bar watching my friend Periscope for a while, so that was fun. She kept me company while I was drinking wine in the wine bar.
Oh, what friend was with you?
She wasn't with me. She was on Periscope.
Oh, I'm like, I thought you were alone there. Got it.
No, I was. But I wasn't, because she was Periscoping, and I got to interact
with her. That's
funny. So I landed in San Diego with almost, it was uneventful. Like, after the what happened at the airport, I was fully expecting this to be, like, the trip from H-E-L-L, but it wasn't, actually.
Until
later.
And your Spanx.
So then I grabbed, there was a super shuttle that went straight to the hotel, actually. So I popped on the super shuttle, got to the hotel. Our friend Sarah was already in the room, so she let me in. And then you guys did your drinking and came back to the...
No drinking. Well, I had one drink.
Whatever you guys were doing. My point is, she drove all my stuff down, but didn't leave her car key in the room. So I've been in these clothes all day long. All I want to do is get my makeup remover and get out of my dress and get showered and get ready for bed.
She had to wait till I got home. What time was it? It was like 10:30 or 11?
It was later than I wanted it to be.
Well, but any time that's not ready for that you're not ready for is later than you want it to be. But anyways, I don't know. I think Mandy was there. She can totally correct me. But I know it was me... Yeah, it was me. I met some friends for a drink.
It's always you.
I know. So that was the first day. The second day was Thursday. And we promise this will not extend longer than Pot Abroad. We're going to get this done.
No, this is going to be one up.
And it's going to actually... One and done. It's actually going to be... But I'm saying it can go pretty quickly because we don't have to remember 87 places that we went. So Thursday... What did you do Thursday?
Thursday I got up super early. Mm-hmm. And I got a shower and I got my hair done and I got ready. And then we went to Comic-Con. I mean, that's kind of what we did. What was funny.
Did we hang together or did I leave you right away and go over to the Hilton?
No, you did not leave me right away. You hung with me for a little bit. And when I was done with you, I sent you on your way.
Good Lord, I forgot about that interview too.
Right? Yes.
Okay. I forgot about that too. We have that to share with you too.
Good grief. So we get there and the whole like shuttle ride over. And the cool thing about Comic-Con is that if you're staying at one of the major hotels in the area, they have a free shuttle that runs 24 hours a day. From your hotel, basically, back to the convention center.
I don't know if it's 24 hours, but I know it goes to like 2 a.m.
They told me it was 24. Somebody told me it was 24. Sarah was telling me it was 24.
Okay, maybe they changed. I didn't think it was before. But when you need it, it's there.
Yeah. So we get on the bus, this giant bus, and we ride it. And Ginger was telling me ahead of time, she's like, well, pack snacks because you're going to be in lines all day. You're going to be doing this all day.
If you want to see stuff, you'll be in lines.
Right.
Potentially.
So I packed, I don't know, I had all these, like, protein bars, and I had some, like, protein chips and bottles of water. I mean, I was packed down like a pack mule on Thursday. I brought entertainment. I didn't really know what I was going to be doing on Thursday, but I packed a bunch of stuff for it. So I'm carrying around a backpack that I instantly regretted, because with each progressive step as the day went on, it was getting heavier and heavier and heavier. But basically, and I was stressing on the drive over because apparently the press line to get press passes on Wednesday, while it moved rather swiftly, was apparently long.
Wednesday or Thursday morning?
Wednesday, when you guys went.
Oh,
it was long, but it moved rather swiftly. Well, when we showed up on Thursday, you know, Ginger was kind of walking me down, and Sarah and Mandy ditched us because they were like, well, we're going to go get into Hall H. We're going to go get into Hall H because the line looks short.
Okay, we'll see you tonight.
Right, because we're like, there's no way we're going to Hall H. I've heard nothing but horror stories about Hall H. I walk up to the area where the passes are, and I mean, I'm walking. This place is huge. I don't think I had any concept of how large this place was.
I tried to tell you, but you don't know until you see it.
Because we're like walking down, and I'm like, have we passed it? Did I pass where I'm supposed to get my pass? And she's like, no, keep going. I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure? And she's like, no, keep going. So we walk what felt like a mile just down the front street there. And then I finally see the sign that says industry and press passes. And there's nobody in it. So I literally walked right up to the table. And the guy was like, show me your, give me your stuff, give me your information. And I gave it to him and he handed me my press badge. And the souvenir backpack with all the stuff in it.
It was one
more thing I had to put in my backpack.
did you keep it, by the way, or did you give it away?
Yeah, I kept it. It's I'm giving it to...
To your daughter.
The Chitlin. Because she likes Teen Titans Go. Because of all of the bags, like, I was looking at them, and as I was looking at these bags, I was never thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm going to keep this bag. I was thinking, I hope I get a cool bag so I can give it to somebody. Because I was thinking, oh, I saw somebody with a flash bag. And I was like, ooh, Cody would love this bag. So I was like, if we could find a flash bag.
Cody was not
right? No, Cody wasn't there. So I did not get a flash bag. And then I was like, ooh, I could get a Supernatural bag. My friend Sandra loves Supernatural. She would love that bag. So all I'm doing is thinking about who would like this bag if I can find a cool bag. And then they gave me a Go Teen Titans or Teen Titans Go bag. And I was like, well, that's done. My daughter's going to want that. So done and done.
But what else did you say? It's like, I can make a dress for this year.
No, that was the other bag.
Oh, it was
that
massive.
That was huge. That was the bag they handed me on the street that was...
Oh, someone wanted to get rid of.
No, it was... They were handing them out. Like, there was somebody handing out. Like, they had scads of these bags.
Bags are so out of my league. Because last year, I had my massive backpack full of too much stuff. This year, I pared down a little bit, but I still had my backpack. It was a little bit less full, but I still had a backpack. And that's the easiest way for me to walk around, to have hands free. The only problem is, to get anything out, you got to stop, take it off, put it down, open it up, da-da-da-da. So, the only I didn't want to take a purse, even though it's smaller, because a purse, a messenger bag, or you can get something that hangs across your body, but a purse typically is on one shoulder, and I knew that it would just be annoying me. So as hot and sweaty, even though the weather was ridiculously beautiful, as hot and sweaty as I can get walking around and this big old weight on your back, I still wanted a backpack rather than a purse. So that's something that I definitely, when I got the bag, I put it in my backpack the first night, and then of course that I didn't get another one, but I did give it to a friend. I don't need it, I don't have anyone to give it to, and I don't want to carry it back.
Which one did you get?
I have no idea, I have to ask Marifol.
It was probably cool, and I didn't even have an option at it. She didn't even.
It was the same one
that
Sarah got. What did Sarah get?
I don't even know what Sarah got.
So that was.
No, she gave hers to Marifol too.
Oh, see, we.
Marifol got all the bags.
Marifol made out.
Do you want to know where the bags are? Marifol.
Ask Marifol.
And see, Mandy and I went and got lunch at like 2.
Yeah.
And then we did something. I think she wanted to buy some new shoes because her feet hurt.
That's right.
So, and then you guys were saying you guys were done. Meet us back at the convention center. So we went and met you guys at the convention center. You and Sarah.
Okay.
And then you guys were like, let's go to dinner. And Mandy and I were like, we literally just ate. I was like, well, we'll come and hang. So we went and sat and had, while you guys had dinner at that Baja, another Mexican restaurant.
Seriously, we had... I think we ate there 2 or 3 times that in 3 or 4 days. So here's what happened.
Sarah was tired. She wanted to go back to the room because her feet hurt. And you were somebody. You guys were meeting up with some people at that restaurant. So you guys stayed and I went back with
Sarah. Because you never
Sarah.
Ever meet up with anyone at Comic-Con.
Ever.
Ever.
And I went with Sarah because, you know, someone. I felt like we should stay together in some way, shape, or form. So I went with Sarah back to the hotel room. And then you guys stayed. And then what ensued, well, what happened for me was on our way back to the shuttle, we walked by this, like, carnival, this, like, outdoor little carnival that had food trucks. Like, there was a grilled cheese food truck that did all kinds of grilled cheese. And then there was a Hello Kitty food truck that had, like, donuts and macaroons and lemonade. And then there was sort of a Point Break, like, wagon, or like a RV kind of thing where you went inside and they showed you, like, the trailer for Point Break, and then you watched part of the, like, a scene from it in 3D. And Sarah was like, I really want to do this Point Break thing. And I was like, okay, we can do it. And then they made us sign waivers. And I was like, okay, this is going to be awesome if I have to sign a waiver, right? Because they're like, oh, well, it's really intense. It's like the original movie, but, like, more intense. Like, they kept saying intense. Like, that was there. It was, no. It was more extreme. But more extreme. And I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be extreme. Well, we get inside, and we sit down, and then my phone starts buzzing. And I have a missed call from a number I don't recognize. And I was like, well, I can't answer it now because the lights were going down and I had to go to this extreme trailer, which, can I tell you, I don't think that I should have needed to sign my life away because there was nothing dangerous and or really extreme about the experience. It looks like a cool movie, but my life was never threatened. So that waiver was silly. But we came out and I was texting Mandy and I was like, hey, what's going on? She was like, oh, we thought we needed you, but we didn't. And I was like, well, that's cryptic. What does that mean?
Mandy said that?
Yeah, because she's the one who called me. So I had a missed call from Mandy, and I was kind of texting her back. I was like, well, what's going on? She was like, oh, no big deal. We thought we needed you, but we don't. And I was like, well, that's cryptic, and why don't you need me?
So what exactly went on while you were away from me?
There were a series of texts back and forth between one of our cousins and I, and I found out that our cousin works at a certain restaurant on a certain island that rhymes with Dornado.
Nice.
And near or with, that's associated with the hotel there. And he's basically saying that he was talking to someone about his cousin has a podcast and it was about a show. But our cousin was just saying, there's this guy and he's the composer of Outlander. And I thought, there's no way. First of all, what the heck? There's just no way. So I said, what's his name? And our cousin said, tell me his name and I'll ask him. Nice. So I said, okay, is it Bear? And he comes back and he says, yes, that's him. And I thought, are you kidding me? This is just too much of a coincidence. This is too small of a world. So he said that Bear asked if we wanted to do an interview, and I'm like, well, yeah, of course. So we had to arrange it. So I gave my cousin our number to share, and that was Friday or Thursday. I guess it was Thursday night. Anyway, we gave our cousin our number, and he passed it on. And the next and last thing we heard from our cousin was that Bear would pass it to his publicist. And we're like, oh, okay. So, you know, maybe it'll be in a few weeks, right? I mean, or honestly, at least it's not going to happen at Comic-Con.
Right.
Something like that.
It's not like, oh, this is going to happen in like soon. 2 or 3 days. It's something where you're like,
we'll get in touch with you
for the long haul. So this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow, but it may happen a few months from now.
Long story short, Saturday we had arrangements to meet and do one-on-one, do a face-to-face interview. So this was our Comic-Con surprise. The progression of music between like season one and season two, obviously you have a different, same time period, minus, well, no, you had a little bit of the 60s, mm-hmm. but influence, but predominantly the biggest change is going to be that courtly music, the courtly, mm-hmm. the more classical sound.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that progression, how you dove into that.
Well, it's a little early. I actually haven't yet started, but I'm in my research phase right now, and so I can talk about what I think I'm going to do, mm-hmm. and then we can compare it to what I end up doing.
Absolutely.
But it's like you said, there is a courtly aspect to this. There's an upper class aspect to this, And much of the music I did in season one was very folk-influenced. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to hear a difference as our characters go from one environment to the other. And actually, we had a little bit of this in mm-hmm. season one with the Duke of Sandringham, and also even with Colm McKenzie, with his music, I still used folk instrumentation, but I tried to give it a sense of authority. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I have been researching a lot of French music of the period. We're probably going to be hearing a lot more viola da gamba and other classical instruments, and probably fewer of the folk instruments. But then again, it's a little early in the process, and I really won't make up those decisions until I'm able to sit down and really look at the episode and get a sense of what it is.
Last time we spoke briefly about what you had been able to do because of the release of the first half of the soundtrack for the season 1A.
Mm-hmm.
So season 1B, of course, a lot darker.
Yeah.
And especially, although we could talk about many things, many playful things, many dark things in the second half, what, I don't know if I want to say inspiration, but how is it like? Where did you have to dig down into? What was that like for 15 and 16 specifically?
Yeah, 15 and 16 were really rough because we see characters that we like enduring really traumatic, horrible physical and emotional events. And I'm a bit of a method actor when it comes to the way I write. I don't write intellectually. I don't think about the kinds of chords that one would use for that scene. I just don't function that way. I have to feel that emotion, even if I have to channel up things in my own life that made me feel certain ways. And then once I feel that way, then I start writing music and it comes out. So it was very difficult doing those scenes, even the scene in 15 with the nail. I'll keep it spoiler free in case anyone hasn't seen it, but you know the scene I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
The scene with the nail, after a couple hours, my hand started to hurt. I had sympathy pains in my hand, and I had to stop writing. Mm. And I couldn't take it. I mean, I'd been working on that scene for... I'd been working on the whole scene all day, but that exact moment, the hammer the third time, I lived in that 15-second period for about an hour, and then I couldn't take it anymore. So I got through it. But it was difficult. But that's one of the really fun things about working on a show that's this good, is you get to channel really powerful emotions and then hopefully help the audience feel those emotions.
You graduated from USC.
Yes.
You are obviously a passionate, very talented. You've been described as a wunderkind, kind
of. Oh, now, well, I won't argue that. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Do you, as someone who is so successful and so talented and has had such amazing opportunities, Outlander being one of them, how do you feel that you can give back? Or do you mentor youth?
Oh, you know, the short answer is yes. The long answer is that I was very fortunate to have a mentor myself, a composer named Elmer Bernstein, who was and remains in history one of the greatest film composers to ever live. His mentor was Aaron Copland.
Oh, my Lord.
And he did The Ten Commandments, The Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape, Ghostbusters, Animal House. I mean, he did it all. And for whatever reason, he helped me, you know, when I was very young. I was in high school when I met him. And I worked with him for about 10 years. And I definitely like to always find talented people and try to help them. And in some cases, it means building up people around me that actually work for me. And there's a number of young composers that work for me now that are getting to do some really wonderful things. And I really invest my time in helping them find themselves creatively. And then even in other times, sometimes I just run into somebody who wants me to listen to something and tell them what I think. And if I can, I will, you know, because I feel like Elmer did so much for me, so much, that anything I can do to help somebody else figure out a way to achieve their dreams in film music, anything I can do to help that, I will.
So you work on so many shows. You have at the same concurrently.
Yeah.
And so many different types of shows with different types of music.
Yeah.
How do you manage to juggle all of that and still do it to such a superb level?
Well, thank you. You know, it's a lot of work. I don't sleep a whole lot. But also, as you said, the shows are very diverse. So I find it all to become sort of a tornado of inspiration, where I can work in one language on one show, and then I can kind of change gears and work on something entirely different, and I get to bounce around. And I have found that really does inspire me. Oddly, when I was doing Battlestar Galactica, it was my first project, and it was all I did for a couple of years, and I found it more exhausting because I just lived in the world of Battlestar Galactica so much mentally. I had never escaped it. I couldn't get out of it, which was good. I mean, it was a great experience. But then as I started to diversify and I had the chance to work on a Terminator show or Eureka, which I worked on for a long time, it actually really helped refuel my creative tanks. So I found I thrived that way.
As amazing as it was to, as you say, work on something like Battlestar and be immersed in it, being so immersed does not really force you to really manage your time.
Well, exactly. You can, you know, I'm a perfectionist and I'm detail oriented, and I can, you know, you just fall down the rabbit hole sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really good. And beyond that, I've been so fortunate with the projects that I've been able to work on. I mean, when I started chatting with Ron Moore about Outlander, I knew it would be a lot of work. I knew it would be a huge time commitment. I assure you, it didn't even occur to me to ever think, would I have time for this? No, you don't think that when Ron calls you about Outlander. You just do it, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
So, in general, and this can be for Outlander, for any of the shows, or how you work in general, when you come up with, when you develop your character themes,
mm-hmm.
the little snippets, or, mm-hmm. or long snippets, however they come out, do you start with, do you get a feeling in your head of what you want it to be, and you do you let the tone drive you, and then you find instruments to make it work? Or do you think of an instrument, oh my gosh, this person is, it's a very, like, it's a young, it's a virginal character,
yeah.
she's got to be a flute or something, so
yeah.
I got to develop
that.
No,
tuba. Of course.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah,
you're right.
That's
you're
obvious.
Right.
Well, you know, you're hitting on some very interesting and observant issues, because when I think about a character theme, I think about tone, instrumentation, melody. That's the third one. And all three influence one another. I like to think about what instruments are going to represent this character, so I tend to write a melody that will sit well. But I think above all, the first thing I think about is tone. Because tone, to me, is a way in to even not only a character theme, but a whole project. What should it feel like? And then once you answer that, the question of, well, what instruments am I going to use? What is the melody going to be? I find answer themselves once I kind of get a sense of what the tone is. And the tone is directly influenced just from watching whatever I'm scoring, you know. And that's really how I approach all writing, not just themes. It's just I start with the tone and then work from there.
What drew you to want to major in theory of composition? And what would you say to someone, some young composers or wannabe composers, if
yeah.
you will, who have a mind for it but are maybe not too sure of themselves or not quite ready to they're music majors, but they're not ready to declare?
Well, I almost have to recuse myself from this because I was so... I think I was a bit unusual. And I knew I wanted to do this when I was five.
Oh, wow.
So...
What a blessing. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
It was all I ever wanted to do. And in high school, in middle school and high school, I just tried writing music all the time. When I was in high school, I wanted to know if I could score a film. So I wrote a script for a stupid adventure movie. And then I spent a year getting up at like 5 in the morning, going to school, getting up at 5 in the morning, writing, going to school, coming back, and I wrote an entire film score, a 75-minute swashbuckling adventure film score, because I had to know, it was like 16, I had to know if I could do it, if I could develop a theme, if I could, you know. And so when it came time to even a think about going to college. Like, I only looked at places with good film music programs. I only applied to USC because Elmer said, that's where you go to study film music. Mm. In hindsight, that was a little risky. Elmer taught there, and I had to get a scholarship, too. There was no way I could have done that. But the stars aligned, and I got into the film scoring program. I got into the music program. I got the scholarship that I needed. So the question of what am I doing was never there. What I would say to an aspiring composer, I would say the biggest thing you need is the desire. So to someone who's casually interested in film music, I think the tough love answer is really think twice before setting out. Because the people you're going to go up against are the people like me. The people who got to USC when they were 18 and had already been writing film music, even badly, as I did. But I'd been writing it for over 10 years. I'd been trying already. Mm-hmm. And I the people that I know that are successful today were like me then. Really driven and just starving for it. And it's, if there's anything else you want to do, do that. Now, with that said, if you ask yourself those questions and there's nothing else you want to do and you want to do it, then I think it's a really wonderful way to be expressive and a wonderful way to be creative. And everyone says it's competitive, but if you're really passionate about it, I think there is a place for passionate, driven, dedicated, friendly, talented people. I mean, I really do. I don't think it's like a pie in the sky dream to want to do it. But that's the thing, you have to want to do it.
This is a really general but big question, and I mean it for your music, but this also pertains to life.
Okay.
What inspires you?
I am inspired, well, I'll start with music, and we might get metaphysical into life, but I'm inspired by narrative and drama. I find drama inherent in everyday life. Like, I'm fascinated by two people talking and like what the subtext is. What are they really talking about? What is their body language saying? These are the kinds of things filmmakers, a good filmmaker, will put into their project. And for me, I find that very inspiring. I'm far more inspired to score a scene where two characters are talking and the true conflict is underneath their dialogue than to score an action scene where somebody's being chased down a hallway. I mean, I'll do that too. It's fun. But I really am just a sucker for good drama. And I hear music so quickly when those elements are clicking, when you've got the right cast and a good script and it's been produced well. And I just can watch it and I think I start hearing things right away. That's really fun, and it's interesting because I have a bit of a reputation of being like the genre guy, the sci-fi guy, the horror guy. But when you look at the projects that I've done in those genres, they're really not surface level scores. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me once when I was doing Battlestar, well, what's it like doing sci-fi music, not the channel, the genre, and I thought, I can't even answer that. I don't think I'm doing sci-fi music.
Yeah.
I'm telling this story that happens to take place on a spaceship, but it doesn't even occur to me. Mm-hmm. So it's like I said, I've been very fortunate that the kinds of projects I work on are the ones that are like that. In life, I'm inspired by family and friends and social interactions, but in a weird way it kind of boils down to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It boils down to, I like being around people and...
Did you get to see me in the fireworks?
Just sensing what's working and what's not and where's the drama, you know? Like, it's like big feelings, you know? Like when I had my daughter in my hand who was just born a year ago, and it's like I'm overcome with feelings for her, and it's like all of that I put into a piggy bank in my heart, and when I need it for music, I pull it out.
That made me think of something. When you're you like to people watch, you like to observe.
Oh, I people watch
all
the time.
And just see what's going on. Do you ever like start to score in your mind about what they're doing? Do you hear stuff
constantly? Constantly.
Oh,
I mean, I'm sitting at a restaurant and and observing people. The most visceral one I remember, I was at a restaurant, and there was a woman who was there when we got there, sitting by herself, and she was had the menu, and the guy came by. He's like, "Do you want something else to drink?" She's like, "No, no, no." Her body language said, "I'm waiting." She kept waiting, and she kept waiting. We got our food. We got our drinks. We got our dessert. She kept waiting, and it was like an hour, and you could just see, like, she's been stood up. And I just, I wanted to go over and say something to her, but it's like, it would have embarrassed her even more. I think she just, you could see it on her face, but I was just like, that's a scene. That's a scene there. Like, I could make a short film of this and just write this piece of music for this woman. I don't know. I guess I always kind of observe things like that. And maybe I can't shut it off, because that's just what I do all day. All day, I look at a scene that somebody has written and shot cut together, and it's like, I want to tell a story about a woman who's on a blind date and gets stood up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you look for the things, like her body language changes, or she puts her head in her hands, and that's, it's like, oh, that's where the strings come in, or piano there, or the waiter comes by and she, you know, all these little shifts and these little dramatic moments. I'm always looking for those, so they're there in real life, I'll see them there too.
I've already touched on this because you haven't really started season two, reimagining of the Jamie and Claire theme.
Yeah, so
the theme will likely stay the theme because mm-hmm. that's what it is. But depending on circumstance, might we hear that in a slightly different tone?
I definitely think that that's possible. And when I wrote that theme, oh my gosh, there's a fourth thing when I'm writing a theme. I said, what did I say? Tone, instrument, melody. There's a fourth one, and it applies to TV more than movies. You got to plan for the future. You got to plan for being able to adapt the theme in ways that maybe you don't even foresee. So with the Jamie and Claire theme, I wrote it in such a way, there's aspects of it that I know I can draw from and do new variations of that people will still recognize. Because I knew that this is going to be an evolving theme over hopefully a very long time.
Your lips to God's ears. You hear that, God? You hear that, everybody?
So if that ends up being the case, I wanted to write a melody that had a lot in it. Mm-hmm. And when you look at that theme, there's so many different components to it. There's major components and minor. There's big leaps in the melody. There's scalar motion in the melody. There's all kinds of things that I can start picking apart. And again, it really depends on, I got to see the drama and look for those moments. But I have my toolbox ready when I see them.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Gosh, well, thank you so much, Bear, for chatting again. And we look forward to maybe catching up once we've seen season two.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
So after the interview, we were discussing how funny it was that Bear had connected with our cousin out on this island that rhymes with Dornado. And he said, "Was that your cousin?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that was our cousin." So he was saying it was really funny how they kind of connected as far as finding out what the show was, because he was saying that, oh, my cousin does a podcast, my cousins do a podcast, and it's for the show, and the show's, it's only British actors, and it's filmed in Ireland, and it's on some kind of, like,
Cinemax
or something.
I mean, that
sounds
like an awesome show. I'd like to watch it.
And it sounds like, I lost my train of thought. And it's on Cinemax or something. And so Bear said he was trying really hard to figure out what this show was, to try and help Jared figure out the name of this podcast. And he was thinking, I mean, Game of Thrones is filmed in Ireland, but that's not what he's talking about, because it's on HBO. And he was trying to, like, basically troubleshoot this conversation. And he's like, well, there's only, like, one other period series that is filmed anywhere near a place like Ireland. And it happens to be filming in Scotland. And he's like, and I work on that show. So he said to our cousin, do you mean by chance Outlander? And our cousin's like, yeah, that's it. The Outlander podcast. And Bear said, I work on that show. I'm the composer. And my cousin was, you know, wow, oh my gosh. And then that's when he started to text us, like, where, you know, I have the composer of Outlander here. And I was like, what? That's how the whole, like, snowball got started.
What was super funny about the whole thing is, like, earlier in the evening, he was like, hey, come out to where I work. And we're like, why would we come out to where I work? What does that have to do with anything? Because he works in San Diego.
And this is before anything happened.
But I don't think either of us realized that he not only worked in San Diego, but he worked on Coronado, which is where, you know, a lot of the celebrities stay when they come to Comic-Con.
Or at least, yeah, at different times, yes. They stay all over. But it was just very surreal and very, very, very from what I'm learning as time goes on, it was very Comic-Con-like. Things happen at Comic-Con that, in a very strange, wonderful, magical way, that you have to be open to. And of course, I'm not going to say no to speaking with Bear. And then, of course, we have the Outlander Roundtable we were able to be part of. This consisted of myself and a number of other outlets sitting at a table, while asking questions and recording, while Sam Heughan, Katrina Balfe, Diana Gabaldone, and Ron Moore basically circulated throughout the room. So they had to get up and walk around because there were fewer of them. So they would come to the table and sit down, and then people would ask their questions and they would answer, and in a certain time allotment, and then they were moved to the next table. That was the order of interviewees that our table had: Sam, Katrina, Diana, and Ron. And here is the audio of that roundtable.
Yeah. You see a lot of people walking around looking like you?
I haven't seen any yet. But we haven't been in the center yet. So, hey. Uh-oh.
Oh, you haven't gone to walk the floor or anything yet?
We haven't yet, no. We are doing the panel today, so and then we're doing some signings. Hopefully we get to walk through then. We've just been busy. We're doing press stuff.
How are you guys scheduled out?
It's pretty insane. Yeah. Yeah, yesterday was pretty crazy. I did a panel yesterday, which was good. We did the Warrior panel, Warriors, which was awesome. Good fun in Hall H, so it was like...
Mm-hmm. Like
6,000 people?
Yeah.
You can't see the back. But there was one woman in the front row who, I don't know if she was dead or asleep, I'm not sure.
I saw that picture. Yeah. Coco Pipkin was standing there to take a picture of you, and somebody snapped a picture of Coco with that woman behind her.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She thought you were great in the panel.
Oh, that's kind. They were very funny guys. There were a lot of redheads there as well, which was good.
Yeah. Redheads are good?
Yeah.
So how did you get into the mindset of that Wentworth prison scene? I mean, how did you keep yourself there?
Oh, yeah, wow. So, yeah, we knew it was coming up. I was excited by it and nervous, but, yeah, we knew it was going to be challenging, and we wanted to go as, you know, make it challenging for the actors as well as the audience. And we kind of approached it basically like any other sort of theatre piece. Myself and Tobias, both from theatre background, and we sat with the director and the writer for about a week of rehearsals, discussed the scenes, sort of cut them down a bit. So so we sort of pretty much worked out what we want the audience to feel, what we wanted them to see, and pretty much set the guidelines and the boundaries of, you know, just doing the scene. And then we filmed it over a space of about 2 weeks, and it was pretty intense stuff, primarily because of the content, but also there was a lot of prosthetic work. So I'd be in at 4 a.m. and not finish till 10 at night or something. So they were long days, but in a way that was perfect because it got me into that mindset of, you know, I had like 3 or 4 hours in the morning to sort of prep and stand there as people were sort of painting stuff on your body. And then in the evening, you know, taking it off was a good way to sort of to lose the day's the day's filming. But it was heavy stuff. But we knew we were doing something quite bold, and I was excited to see the end product.
Your character begins season 2 at a completely different place than he begins season 1. What do you see as the challenges or benefits of this in approaching the new season?
In a way, I suppose it's more of a challenge, actually, because, you know, the first season, just Jamie is, he's got no responsibility. He's pretty much out, you know, looking after himself, and he's just reacting to every moment. And then suddenly he... in season two, it's completely different. You know, we've got the overhang or the hangover from you know, the trauma of season one, and also the responsibility of having a wife, of being, you know, a father, of having, you know, becoming a parent. So, yeah, he's had to grow up, and season one he certainly did. Season two, he's still trying to come to terms with the events of season one, but also he's gone to Paris, which is not alien to him, but it certainly is a world that he's not particularly comfortable in, and he's having to assume a new identity there as well. So it certainly feels that he's a different person.
There's been kind of an ever-changing cast. I mean, you and Katrina are going to be the only ones that are pretty much constant throughout however many seasons this runs. I mean, how is that for you, for an actor, to be constantly have different actors and characters to interact with?
Yeah, it's wonderful. We're in the French court at the moment. Myrta is the other character who's with us, who's traveled to France.
Yes, that's true.
So Duncan McCoy is terrific. And but it's just the three of us, and we've got this cast of French actors who are all amazing and bring a totally different energy to it and a different world. And that's what the joy of our show, I think, is that it's always moving and constantly changing, you know, locations and storyline. But also, yeah, it feels a little sad. You know, we kind of miss the old school, the boys, but we know we're going back there. The second half of the season is very much going to be, you know, the antithesis to the first half. The first half is very ostentatious and luxurious, and the costumes are amazing. And the second half is going to be more mud and blood and battles. It's nice to be in a different world. And I know that this series does constantly travel, and that's going to be the journey. And Jamie and Claire are going to develop, and the characters are going to develop.
What are Jamie and Claire trying to accomplish in this first half of the season?
Yeah, so they're here to change history, basically. The Battle of Culloden, you're very popular, is Battle of Culloden was basically, you know, that we keep talking about in season one as well. It was this big battle that happened between the British and the Highlanders. The Bonnie Prince Charlie, who believed he was the rightful king, and he probably was a Stuart king, he came to Scotland to try to rally the clans to put himself back on the throne and overthrow the Hanoverian kings. And it failed, basically. This battle, they got wiped out. And then the repercussions were that the British army banned the whole Highland culture, the wearing of kilts, the speaking of Gaelic, the bagpipes. There were the Highland clearances where people were, you know, put on boats and sent to different countries. And so, therefore, you know, all these people were doomed. So they're there to change history. That's pretty much what they're there for.
Okay.
Can you talk
a little bit about Claire and Jamie's relationship and how it starts
with the relationship? Yeah, well, you know, in season one they were newlyweds, they were young lovers, and they were finding out about each other, and obviously we're still finding out about each other, but yeah, it's moved on, moved forward. The trauma of the end of the season has affected the relationship a lot. Also the fact that she's a parent. She's a mother, and he's obviously, you know, got the responsibility of being a father. So it's they're working it out together, but there's a lot of issues they haven't dealt with yet, and we do play that out in the season. But ultimately, you know, the mission is the most important thing: changing history and making sure that everyone survives. But yeah, their relationship will never be the same again.
Talk about some of the new allies or foes for Jamie and Claire.
Yes, well, yeah, we have a lot of terrific actors that have come in. Dominic Pignon, Marc Duret, there's countless. We have Mother Hildegard, Francis de la Tour. So some really, you know, powerful, amazing actors are coming in and bringing in a different dimension to the show. It becomes almost a different kind of battle with the politics that are played out. Saint-Germain, who's the extraordinarily good-looking actor, Stanley Weber, and who's French and very interesting, and I think he's going to do very well. It's a different kind of enemy that they're facing. And obviously there are also new relationships, new friendships that they build. There's a surrogate son almost that they get, this adopted son in Fergus, who brings another dimension, a dynamic to their relationship. So yeah, it's all sort of moving their relationship forward, and there are never any moments of peace, really.
How is Jamie, like, now that he's an expected father, is that going to change his behavior at all, or even his behavior towards Claire? Might he not take as many risks or things like that while they're in France?
Yeah, I think, you know, before he met Claire, that he, you know, the skin on his back, you know, he was more than happy to put his body on the line, but now he has to think twice about that. And that's one of the lessons he's learned in season one, and in season two, you know, he's still the same guy and still can be hot-headed at times or stubborn, but he certainly has grown up a bit and knows that he's got a responsibility. At times he does forget that.
What does having been on such a Scottish or Scotland celebrating show have done for your personal national identity and pride in your country?
I think you put it there. I think I've become very proud of Scotland. I've gone back to Scotland and sort of rediscovered my country. I've fallen in love with it again, and I'm very proud of you know the production. You know, it really shows off Scotland. I think the craftsmanship, the locations, the studios we've got now, is we've got four sound stages, we've got whole workshops, we've got one workshop where they're just building French furniture, we've got another workshop where they're doing the props. It really is magnificent, and it's creating a lot of industry for Scotland. It's attracting more productions, other TV shows and films as well. So yeah, I'm delighted that we've been given that opportunity. And we were at this in Edinburgh International Film Festival, and I got to meet the culture minister for Scotland, and it feels, you know, that we're not a player in politics, but we're certainly, you know, it's been realised that it's a great thing for Scotland and the UK as well.
How do you play a damaged character without playing a victim?
Jamie did get some resolution at the end of season one. I mean, he was not cured in any way, but he's moving forward. But I spoke at length to our on-set doctor about, you know, obviously the medical conditions and what happens on the psychology as well. But ultimately, I think everyone's different and everyone deals with trauma in different ways. And Jamie is very particular in the way he deals with things. And, you know, before we've seen, you know, when he got whipped or other scenarios in season one, he kind of just lets it float off his back. But this has certainly affected him. But, you know, he's not a victim. He's moving forward. He's got this mission. He's there for a purpose. And it's not weighing him down and incapacitating him. But he has things he's got to deal with. And it's we've just finished filming the moment when he maybe finds some resolution. And that's kind of nice to see. That's something that brings him out of himself. And I discussed them, and it seemed that in a lot of cases with people that did have some sort of trauma, that it would be something really random that would trigger that moment of healing or moving forward. I'm very lucky to be able to play that part. I think it's an interesting character to play.
She's going to have an interesting journey in the second season. Are you really looking forward to taking this path with her?
Yes, I really, you know, I think Claire in season one was very reactionary. You know, she being thrust into this new world and sort of having one event after another just sort of happen to her. It was, you know, there wasn't so much time for contemplation or really, you know, life was sort of thrust upon her rather than her kind of figuring out what she wanted. And I think the season two is very different. I mean, first of all, you have they make this decision to try and change the course of history, and there's a lot of, you know, thinking about, you know, I think her pregnancy has a lot to do with that. I think also trying to lift Jamie out of sort of the effects of last season, and give him a mission and give him something to sort of strive to do. You know, you see her trying to create a world that she wants to live in, and you know, there's some incredible storylines or plot parts coming up, and you know, yeah, I'm really excited to play them.
Claire had a relatively unstructured upbringing with her uncle and the travel and everything. Mm-hmm. She had to adopt to 18th century Scotland, mm-hmm. adapt. And how does Claire feel about and handle the rules of the French court and all the etiquette that comes with that?
It's a huge adjustment for her, and in a way she had much more freedom in 18th century Scotland than she does when she first lands in Paris, and I think, again, you know, finding her place in a very patriarchal society where the role of women is very restricted is tough for her, and it's not where she's most comfortable, but you know, what I love is she manages to find an outlet for her independence, for her sort of her professionalism in a way. You know, she meets Master Raymond, Mother Hildegard, which are two great characters that are coming in, played wonderfully by Dominique Pignon and Francis de la Tour. You know, it's tough. It's a really, I think both her and Jamie struggle in the beginning. They're very much in a place where it's not their comfort zone. But they have to use sort of their intelligence and their smarts to figure out a way to navigate this new place. But it's interesting to see them inhabit a new world and how that affects them. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the second season, you see Claire and Jamie arrive in France. They've made a decision to change the course of history if they can, so they want to stop the Jacobite Rising. Claire is also pregnant, so a lot of it is dealing with the political intrigue, but also dealing sort of in private with her own pregnancy and the insecurities that brings up and the fear that kind of brings up, because she lost her parents when she was 5, and so she didn't really have this mother role model to, you know, who that she can sort of look back to or go to for guidance, and it's a real time of uncertainty for both of them. And then, you know, towards the second half of the season, you will see them return to Scotland. So it's in a way, it's a season of two halves again. But, yeah, it's going to be very visually very different in the beginning.
How was it working with Dominique Pignon and Master Raymond? Because that's very much a counterpart to Claire in France.
Very much so. You know, I liken it to when she first met Galas. You know, it's again this person that she has a like-minded, you know, they have a like-minded interest in herbs and healing, and you know, it's the first friend she sort of makes in Paris. He is an absolute joy. I am a big fan of his work anyway from before, and when I heard they cast him, I was kind of astounded. I was like, wow, we've got Dominique Pignon. And he's just such a joy in work. He's bigger than life, but, you know, he's just a real unique, fantastic character, and he plays him so brilliantly. So yeah, it's fantastic.
You've been getting a lot of well-deserved great notice for your performance in Outlander. What has this done for your career in general? Are you getting more calls? Are you getting more opportunities coming your way?
We got more calls, and I'm like, well, I'm kind of busy at the moment.
But you're still doing things.
Yeah, no, it's been fantastic, of course. It's opened so many doors for me. You know, I was very lucky. I got to do a great film during the hiatus. And hopefully, you know, during the next hiatus, I'll get to do something else as well. But, you know, we shoot for a very long time, so it's a limited time in between. But, you know, I as an actor, you first and foremost just want to work, you know, and then to be able to get a job that you love is amazing, and then that people respond to and they like, it's just, I couldn't be happier and more grateful at the moment. So.
Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of Jamie and Claire's relationship and how she approaches it now?
Well, when we meet them at the top of the season, he's still struggling with what happened at the end of last season, and you know, we really wanted this to be a continuation. You know, it's not a reset. So, you know, you see two people who are very much still affected by everything that's happened, and I think Claire really has to put aside maybe some of her own issues at the moment to really help him get past what happened and heal. And part of that is giving him a mission and giving him something to focus on that's not looking back on what had happened. So they're going through a very uncertain time. They're struggling with their own issues and maybe sometimes privately, which is creating a bit of a gulf between them. But ultimately, they're there for each other and they're working to try and help each other. And you know, you see continuously, as with anything in life, you know, adversity and getting past adversity will make you stronger. And you know, I think that's a beautiful thing about this couple.
How do those incredible costumes help you get into Paris?
I mean, it does. It changes everything. The minute you put on a corset, it changes how you sit, how you breathe, how you feel. And Claire's discomfort in this new world and in all of this finery, you know, it mirrors what you're going through. You know, it's the costumes are so beautiful and it does, it just makes you feel like you're in a different place. And you know, whereas before, you know, I love a pocket. And before Claire, and that was the one thing from the 40s, I was like, Claire likes her pockets in the 40s. So in the 18th century, women had pockets in their skirts. And so there was a lot of pockets. And, you know, you could trunch around the fields and all of that. And there's none of that in this. It's, you know, it's pristine satins and silks and, I mean, the most exquisite stuff. But it's just a very different, you know, you have to carry yourself very differently, and it really does inform it all.
Since you say it affects how you play the character, do you guys rehearse in the costumes, or are you just...
This year, because it takes so long to get dressed, usually I get half ready for rehearsal. You know, we'll come in and we'll block the scene and we'll do a rehearsal. So I'll usually just have the underwear, as they call it, but that's already three layers. That's like the corset, the bum roll, the cage, if there is a cage, because we have to rehearse with the dimensions.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because that's also a big thing, because, you know, they can't really... They're like, oh yeah, just stand together, and you're like, yeah, but I'm this wide. It does affect things, so yeah, we do have to.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you
so much.
Hello.
Good afternoon. You guys all have much bigger, hunkier. They'll have little tiny ones over there. Seems like you might get better sound.
That's
hope for the best. Huh?
Yeah. What was your reaction to the very first episode of They Allowed You to See?
Oh, I was just blown away by it. I actually got to see it in the production suite with the film editor and with Ron, and they were showing me the rough cuts of the first two episodes together, and it was so sweet. The film editor actually cried. Yes, because he said, it's just so great to see this for the first time.
As we wait, of course, to learn who will be cast as Brianna and Roger, what are some of their individual characteristics from the novels that you look forward to seeing being adapted, being brought to screen?
Well, it's hard to say because so much of it depends on the actor, mm-hmm. you know, what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sam, for instance, is a very analytical actor, and he has read the book several times, and you can see him do Jamie's little physical things, like drumming his fingers when he's thinking and so forth, which he's picked up, and those are conscious decisions. At the same time, you instantly grasp the emotional sense of Jamie. The very first time I saw him in an audition tape, I'm I never thought they would find anyone who could do that, and he did it just like that, you know. So and you know, it was just amazing. At the same time, there's a certain, you know, Samness to him. So it's very weird to be sharing joint custody with a character. It's like that. Yeah. And Katrina, everybody's take is completely different. It took them forever to find a Claire, and you probably have heard the story about how they sort of picked her out of the slush.
Yeah.
So to speak. But she just walked into that part and inhabited it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And her physique is not as described in the book, but it doesn't matter, you know. But I've always said to people, it just doesn't matter that much what an actor looks like. It's can they act? And, you know, she just totally had it. So, and it's just instinctive on her part, I think.
Book two begins in a surprising place compared to the end of book one.
I know, people always think they're reading the wrong book.
I've done that. When plotting of season two began, what were the discussions like on how you were going to begin? If you haven't cast Brianna Roger, it's obviously not going to start her
before. Well, then you actually could, because they shoot things out of sequence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in fact, that doesn't actually tell you anything, except that they haven't cast them yet, or at least that they haven't told you if they have. But, no, I actually was not involved in the discussion of how to break the story, so to speak. They do show me the script outlines and the scripts. They show me the footage that they shoot and the rough episodes as they come together, which is great. I love to see that. But, you know, I am very seldom actually in the writer's room, you know, discussing things with them. That is their job. And, I'm happy to contribute, opinions. And sometimes I'll read a script and I'll say, I understand why you did it this way, but, you know, you could do it that way and get more of the original book in and then move this little piece over here. And sometimes I'll do that, you know. About 9 times out of 10, if I have a concern or a suggestion, they'll take it. And the 10th time, they'll explain why they can't take it.
Do you have been quoted in a few articles that you try to fight for certain scenes? Sometimes that doesn't always work out, like the hot spring scene.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a point where you said, when I sold the book rights, maybe I should have put a little more control in on that contract?
No, you can't. I mean, you just don't. Unless you're J.K. Rowling.
Well, E.L. James, for one. With 50 Shades. That's
maybe she shouldn't have.
A nightmare. Yes, exactly. There you go.
Thank you.
So you would never want to be super that involved.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I don't actually think that's a good thing on the whole. It is... An adaptation is a separate art form unto itself, and what makes a good novelist is not necessarily what makes a good screenwriter or a good showrunner. I don't know whether I would be good at writing a script because I haven't done it, so. But I am positive I would not be a good showrunner. So I think it's much better to let the experts do that.
Yeah.
You know, I can quibble over details. I can tell them, you know, you could do this historically, or you can't do that historically, or, you know, well, it really was this way, but I see why you've done it that way, but could you maybe change this just for a little extra accuracy, things like that.
Yeah.
That can be helpful, but I totally don't want to be in control.
When you started writing, who were your literary influences, and now how do you feel about being a literary influence yourself?
Oh, I'm very
thinking like
of people
a Jed Graham and
Let's see. I had 5 literary role models to start with, you know, people who I was consciously taking craft from, so to speak. And those would have been Charles Dickens, Robert Louis Stevenson, Dorothy L. Sayers, John D. MacDonald, thriller writer, and from him I learned narrative drive and pacing and how to control a series character. Let's see, and P.G. Wodehouse, a British comic novelist who is just fabulous with manipulations of language and a lot of Claire's, the way she talks and her... her, sarcastic interior monologue has come from that.
And then how do you feel about being, you know, like Jen Graham has said that she started her novels because of your writing, and, some other people.
So I'm extremely flattered that they could take anything from me, and they're more than welcome to it.
How has the show influenced the way you write?
Well, really, no. People do ask that all the time, and I can see, why, but... as I say, look, they're working 30 years behind where I am. There's 8 books between me and them, and I've written all this stuff in between. What exactly would I change in the 9th book when these people are now in their 60s that would be affected by what these people are doing now? There's just no way that could happen. Oh, no, I can still see the original Jamie and Claire as they are. Yeah, I mean, it's fun to watch Sam and Katrina, and they're totally Jamie and Claire. When I'm watching the show, but I don't have any problem with show and versus book. I can easily carry both images in my mind.
Fan enthusiasm over the years, has it changed in tone? And by that I mean, and with that, have you had to distance yourself or change how much you engage with them? Because of course, the huge influence with social media.
Well, there's ways and means of dealing with social media. The thing is that I've always been in the middle of it. I was on CompuServe's Literary Forum in 1985. So the social media has just kind of coalesced around me as new bits and technologies came along. I just adapted them when they were useful. I mean, Tumblr and Pinterest, they're not really, they don't offer me anything, so to speak. So I don't do them. I do Twitter because it's good for getting out, you know, quick messages to people and, you know, collecting the fans. If you need to rally them for something, mm-hmm. you can do it way easy that way. Facebook, I love to stay in touch with people. I have a website which is sadly neglected, but I really need to move my stuff from Facebook to there as well so they can have it. But at the moment, the website's more a repository or an archive of information, which is good. But, I was, when I first knew Sam, I was sending him some of the stuff that the fans were saying and so forth, and he wrote back and he said, "Your fans are crazy." He said, "How do you deal with this?" And I said, "Well, there is a way, and I will tell you," because he was on Twitter, that's how we met, and I said, "Look, you take 10 minutes twice a day, you know, only once if that's all that you can afford, but you go on every day, and you don't have to try and read everything addressed to you or pertaining to you, but go through as much as you can in 10 minutes, you know, if someone says it's their birthday, stop and say, happy birthday. Someone says, my dog just died, stop and say you're sorry. If someone says something witty to you and something witty occurs to you, say it back." And, you know, when you hit the end of 10 minutes, stop, you know. But the fact that you do it every day and you are seen to be responding to people, it gives people the feeling that you are actually there all of the time, even though you aren't, and it doesn't eat you alive. Likewise with Facebook, you know, I post usually once a day, maybe twice if there's an announcement or something else that I need to add, but usually once a day. And I'll go for a couple of days without if I'm doing something heavy duty like this. But the fact that I do it regularly, and when I put up a post the next day, I'll take 10 minutes and read through the first two or three screens of comments and reply to the ones that I can easily reply to. And, you know, nobody notices that you're not replying to the ones that you're know, because Facebook helpfully moves all the ones you do reply to up to the top.
Yeah.
So anybody looking is saying, "Oh boy, she's here, she's talking to us, this is great."
Yeah.
So it's partly illusion. But partly I just enjoy engaging with people. I like to talk to people about what it is that I do. I always have. I'm a born teacher, and I love to talk to people about writing and the craft and, you know, how things are done. And now that we have the show, you know, I'm learning so much about the way it's put together. I just really like to share it with people.
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much. With so much of Jacobite history being intertwined with religion, was it a conscious decision to downplay Jamie's faith versus Claire's nominal Catholicism and the deep devotion to the Scottish Pope?
No, it wasn't a conscious decision. I think it was just a question of emphasis. You know, we didn't try to play it down. I guess it just didn't quite play into the story as much. It didn't quite, in the dialogue, I guess we just didn't write to it. We could have. It wasn't really a strategic choice or even a creative choice. It just sort of evolved that way.
With the timeline changing in book two, how difficult was it for you to adapt that and make sure that fans who haven't read the books will understand what's going on?
It's a big challenge. The second book is much more complex. It's a more difficult book to adapt. As a result, shifts point of view, it plays with time, it's more political, it's dealing with the Jacobite Rebellion that most people in this country never even heard of. So it's a challenge. We're always trying to play this to two audiences. It's the book fans, and then there's the general audience that has no idea. And you have to play fair with both. You know, the fans are looking forward to certain things, and you want to satisfy that. And you also want to surprise them. You want to catch them off guard, and sometimes you want to scare them, like, "Oh my God, Frank's going up that hill. If he goes through time, I'm out of the show." You know, and it's great. I'm sitting here watching. I'm like going, across America, people are losing their minds. And that's fantastic. You know, I enjoy that. Because, oh, no, we didn't. Oh, okay.
The teaser where it was actually Claire's dream where she tells
Mrs. Fitz.
Yeah,
exactly.
People were losing it.
I know. And that's fun because, you know, the fans of the book should also have discovery. They should also be surprised. You want to engage their emotions as well. But then there's the other half of the audience that has no idea what the books are about, and you have to tell them the story clearly. They have to be able to follow along. I always make the comparison to Game of Thrones, that I've never read those books, so that TV show has to stand on its own. You know, it has to work for me, and it doesn't matter whether that scene's in the book or not. If I don't get it, I'm not engaged anymore. So we're always trying to sort of keep both elements of the audience in mind.
Since Tobias is not here, I wanted to ask you, how are Tobias and Lawrence
Tobias and what?
Tobias and Lawrence getting along. Is like Lawrence trying to like mimic some of Tobias's mannerisms at all because he's playing his brother?
No, I don't think he is, actually. We've shot some scenes with him, and no, I don't think we've kind of stayed away from it. I mean, the book, they're so close together that they literally, she literally mistakes him for Jack when she first sees him. But
he looks remarkably similar.
He looks pretty close, but there was no, I didn't want to play that gag twice. There was no way you were really going to play. He was Tobias was never going to be Alex as well. Yeah. It was just like he's a bridge too far for us. Yeah. So and yeah, he's not trying to pick up any of his ticks or sort of like a carrier or anything like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Tease some of the new characters we're going to meet this season, for those that are not familiar with the books.
There's several actual historical figures that are in the books for the first time. We're going to meet King Louis XV. The Count de Saint-Germain is a real historical character who's one of the villains of the show. There's a gentleman named Master Raymond who runs an apothecary shop in Paris that becomes a confidant of Claire, and he's got some mystical, interesting things going on in his world. There's Mother Hildegard, who's a nun that runs a hospital in Paris. It's a key player in the show. She has a dog, Bouton, which the fans are right.
Yeah.
It's like, trust me, Bouton is in the show. There's a boy named Fergus that becomes very important, especially as in the book series as it goes forward. It is introduced this year. Bonnie Prince Charlie we meet this year, real historical figure again. I'm sure I'm missing somebody, but those are the key players, I think, in terms of new characters. It's a whole new, Louise de la Tour is a friend of Claire's in Paris who plays an important role.
Jared,
Jamie's cousin, is also a character in the show.
Scotland was like such a major part, obviously, of the first season, the culture and everything of it. It almost kind of became a character in and of itself. For like the first half of the second season, which takes place in France, you guys try to kind of mimic that sensation in a way, kind of do the same thing where, you know, it really, with Claire and Jamie, there's so much discovery and wonder both for them and for the audience.
Yeah, I mean, we're plunging them into another world. There were no costumes, sets, or props that we could use. We had to create a new series for the second season. So for the audience, it'll be just like, wow, this is Outlander. I mean, it won't have any of those elements in it other than the three characters that came over. Everyone else is left behind. It's a whole new world, and it's a whole new story. And eventually it does get back to Scotland, so you'll kind of regain a lot of that stuff from season one. That's a whole new deal. And the rhythm of the scenes are different. The way it's shot is different. The fabrics are different. The color palettes are different. I mean, even the most basic candles are different. The heavy, big candles in Castle Leek are now fine, tapered, candelabras. And, there's a lot of gilt, and there's a lot of fine china and silver. It's just a completely different world that they're living in.
And you
want
to address the time traveling aspect of it and how it affects the future?
Well, their story in season two is they're trying to change history, so that's a pretty big deal. Her knowledge of the future helping inform them to figure out a way to stop the Jacobite Rebellion and stop the disaster at Culloden is sort of the mission statement for season two. There's not a lot of time travel like season one in the show, but it's still like such a key idea that it still kind of propels a lot of the action in terms of what people are doing.
Just to follow, does Claire think about that her future that she knows might be gone if she does change her future? Is that addressed?
A little bit. It's tricky. We try not to play too much of the... we never call them different timelines. We never try to get too far into the science fiction aspect of it. We try to play enough of it so that the concept is clear to the audience, but try not. There are definitely some things she worries about that could be changed by her actions in the past, but we try not to get too bogged down into, the butterfly effect of this or that, because God knows by now the future's taken over by Nazis as far as she knows.
Since it's a larger book and you have three fewer episodes, was it a challenge to maybe fit as much as possible into those 13 episodes?
Definitely, yeah. Another three would have helped, but that's just the gig, It's still more episodes than Starz typically shows, so I'm fine with it. I mean, I knew going in that it was going to be 13. Fortunately, it's the thinnest of the books, so, it's not like the next one, the season, the third book is a whole different animal.
Yeah.
Is there talk of splitting that into maybe two seasons?
We talk about it, but we haven't. No decision has been made. I haven't really focused on it yet. I don't have a third season pickup, so I don't have that problem yet. Eventually, we'll have to have that discussion. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe, maybe not. We've always talked about generally doing a book a season, but there are books that are just big and complicated. But once you do that, are we ever going to get to book 8 or 9? Once you start thinking about how many years we're talking about and I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that yet.
Season one was split into two, and the key art was decidedly different from the blue, kind of glowing, beautiful hues of Scotland to the grittier, more dangerous, darker second half. In season two, the first half is in Paris, or at least the first part, and then they return to Scotland. Has the look been decided for?
For the key art?
Well, the key art, or just the tone?
The Scotland will be a war-torn Scotland, so that'll be a heavier, darker, more threatening sort of environment, which you get when the story gets back to Scotland. But in the Parisian part is much richer and much more, you know, romantic. You know, it's a different world. We play that, so visually it is shot different. It has a different kind of mood and feeling to it. And we haven't done the key art campaign yet at all.
We'll be getting the Emmy nominations will be coming out soon. And Starz made a big push to have fans tweet out and, you know, push for Emmy nominations. Your wife has made no secret of the fact that she doesn't care for this. She doesn't think that Emmys mean a lot. What do you think that awards mean to the show or to your career?
What it means to me is I like being able to go back to Scotland and say, you know what, your work matters. Those people back at the TV Academy recognized you and your peers, and I think that matters. I like those people in all those different departments and the cast, and these people work very, very hard. They all work harder than I do, trust me. You know, they're out lugging cameras around in the dead of night in the goddamn snow. You know, that's tough. So to be able to go back and say, hey, you know, look, here's some gold, or here's this recognition. You know, I think it matters for the morale of the show. I think it matters for people to be acknowledged. If you don't get it, okay, it's fine. You know, Battlestar was ignored year after year after year, and we were still very proud of it, and we were still like, well, screw the world. We know we're doing a great show, and we felt that way, and I was surprised. But it was always really annoying to me that Edward James almost never got a nomination. This is like one of the greatest actors, and he did fantastic work, and I could not believe that year after year that he was ignored. So those things are kind of frustrating, you know. I think that, yeah, I don't think Terry cares a lot one way or another, but I want them to recognize her work. I think that she's done fabulous work. And same goes for the cast, and the same goes for the cinematographers, and on and on and on. I think all these people do really good stuff, and I think it would be nice to have it recognized.
So, how was your first Comic-Con? I know we're going to get to Ballroom 20 next week, but...
Dude, Ballroom 20.
It needs its own episode.
It does. It was epic. I mean, I don't know how you could expect me to discuss even anything that happened in Ballroom 20, considering I was there for like 10 hours in a very brief segment, so it's better we just save it for...
As a little bit
for
of...
For a slightly less packed episode.
A little
episode.
Tease for next week. Oh, next week will be packed, but maybe not quite as packed as this. So, what did you think about... That, I mean, the bear surprise.
That
and the round table.
That was a surprise. I got that surprise while I was sitting in Ballroom 20.
And when we were trying to come up, we did our best with the very last minute, because, again, we found out the morning of the very last minute interview. We were like, okay, we're going to do our best. We're going to do questions that we haven't asked and that, to the best of our knowledge, that we haven't heard. So we tried to ask a mixture of questions, but all of this was being done by my scribble and through emails and texts.
Yeah. No, she was texting
me. The only way.
She was texting me while I was sitting in Ballroom 20. I don't even remember at what point in the day it happened, but I was no longer listening to the panels that I was sitting there waiting for. I had my face down in my phone trying to answer and come up with some questions that might be helpful, or at least maybe give her things that would make her
think of something else. Yeah.
Something else. So
we did our best being totally separated, and well, we asked some friends too.
You're offered an interview with Bear McCreary. You don't
can't.
Say no.
No.
You just don't say no. You're like, yes.
And if I couldn't have made it, you would have had to leave Bar. Oh, no, you couldn't do
you
that.
You would not. You would not.
So it was not bad for your first Comic-Con.
It was definitely good. The only changes I think I would make is that next
your
year.
Your backpack. At least the first day.
No, that's not the only change I would make. That's definitely a change I would make, but that's not the only one. But definitely, I would do some better scheduling. No, the only thing that... One of the things that I would not do again is I would not spend as much time in the exhibit hall. Exhibit hall gets one round.
And that's why you go to preview night.
I know, but I couldn't this year. But one time around, look at everything I want to look at, and then I'm done. I'm not going back into the exhibit hall. I'd rather spend time in panels.
I agree, but unless it's strategic and you have an appointment, that's completely different. But then you're in and you're out. But there is no in and out of that exhibit hall.
Dirty, dirty.
So it was, I almost said, this is really hokey, I almost said it was a treasure. It is a treasure. It's something I will treasure, memories and experiences and meeting other fans, meeting other people from other fan sites or other webs. I mean, it was crazy, but it was so much fun. You think you might want to go back next year?
I mean, I'm definitely going back next year.
Well, hope so, because it'll be good to have you there. So
I mean, I may not hang out with you next year, but well, I'll definitely
we hardly
be there.
Hang out this much this year, but that's because we were separated. But that's okay. There's reasons for that. So that's all good. So we hope you enjoyed our All About Lander at Comic-Con 2015. And next week we will bring you stuff from Comic-Con 2015 that was not Outlander related, because we wanted to use our press badges, put them to good use. Even though we were there as the Outlander podcast, we definitely wanted to make good use of access to other opportunities. What's a little taste of what they might hear next week?
Drunk people.
Well, I don't know if we'll have drunk people, but there'll be talk about drunk people.
Okay, that's
and maybe a certain comedy station channel.
And I will talk an awful lot about Ballroom 20.
And you'll have a lot of Ballroom 20. And there's other stuff. Oh, some sci-fi stuff. If you enjoy, besides the fact that he is the composer for Outlander, which we all appreciate, if you enjoy hearing about composers and their practice, their method, their creative process, then I think you will also enjoy next week's episode, because we were able to speak with a few other composers for some sci-fi and horror shows. So does that about wrap it up?
I mean, we're going to have to wrap that up. I mean, I think this is already a long enough episode.
Yeah, it's all good. Well, thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.